80 years ago, on September 1st, 1939, World War II broke out. Today, we talk about a new novel and a surprising biography that illumine important but lesser-known stories about that conflict. Julie Oringer's novel, The Flight Portfolio, and Robert Mattson's fascinating biography of the young Audrey Hepburn and her work with the Dutch resistance against the Nazis. It's called Dutch Girl. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. In 1940, a young American named Varian Fry traveled to Marseille, France, carrying $3,000 and a list of imperiled artists and writers that he hoped to help escape within a few weeks. Instead, he stayed more than a year. Varian Fry's work for the International Rescue Committee, which he co-founded, saved more than 2,000 Jewish artists, writers, and scholars from almost certain death at the hands of the Nazis. Figures like Marc Chagall, Hannah Arendt, and Arthur Koestler. Varian Fry had a secret that might have helped him empathize with the persecution faced by those he rescued. He was gay. These two parallel stories and the connection between them are explored in Julie Oringer's acclaimed new novel, The Flight Portfolio. Well, Julie Oringer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this was just a terrific novel, The Flight Portfolio. It concerns itself with a rescue operation that American Varian Fry carried out in Vichy, France in 1940 and 1941. Before I ask you to tell us about that operation, tell us first, who was Varian Fry?
So Varian Fry was a New York journalist and editor, Harvard educated, born in 1907, who, with no previous experience doing anything of the kind, went to Marseille in 1940 to try to save writers and artists who had been blacklisted by the Gestapo. And what this meant specifically was that he was the on-the-ground person for an organization, the International Rescue Committee, although at the time it was called the Emergency Rescue Committee, that was basically organized to try to get visa help and papers and money and to deliver protection to refugees who were in danger and who might otherwise have difficulty getting to the States. These were people who had fled to France from the occupied countries, or French people who had fallen into danger once the Vichy regime was in power. And he had a quite limited amount of money and a list of 200 names, and he expected to stay for about a month. And he ended up saving more than 2,000 people and staying for 13 months until finally the French kicked him out. He ended up being the first American to be named Righteous Among the Nations by Yad Vashem, and his impact continues because the work of the artists he saved is with us today and would not have been otherwise had he not done what he did.
Artists were, for example, Marc Chagall, and Chagall and his wife at first were quite confident that they were safe in France because they were naturalized French citizens. Talk about just this whole process of getting people to understand the danger that they were in and moving them to a place where they felt that they really did need to leave.
Yes, well, I think that part of the issue was that France had for so long represented liberté, fraternité, and égalité. It was a kind of beacon for those values in Europe at a time when, you know, fascism was encroaching and people were beginning to be endangered in the surrounding countries. And so once people had landed on French soil and had become patriated there and were in possession of a new life in this place that for so long had stood for liberty, I think it was difficult, first of all, to accept the fact that France had fallen so quickly to the Nazis, and then secondly, to wrap their minds around the idea of going to yet another country and trying to pursue safety there. And I think part of the problem, too, for some of the artists who were quite accomplished was that they felt that their stature would protect them. Chagall certainly did, and so did Irene Nemirovsky, the writer, who was not one of Fry's clients, but who quite famously believed that the French would protect her because of her stature, but also because of the nature of her work. She went so far as to, you know, not lodge direct opposition to the Vichy regime, but to write in certain regards sympathetically. And yet the fact that she was Jewish by birth was far more important ultimately to the Nazis than whatever it was that she was saying. And even though that happened some years after Varian Fry was there, he was an incredibly foresightful person and had spent much of his adult life studying what was going on in Europe, actually visiting Germany, learning on the ground about how the Nazi regime operated. And he saw the writing on the wall. And that was in large part why he decided to undertake a mission that in certain ways seemed impossible.
Yeah, you know, I've often wondered, how would one know when to leave? And what is it like to make that kind of psychological shift? You, as a fiction writer, as you had to kind of create this sense, what was that process for you? How did you uncover this sense of, you know, first of all, privilege, and then of coming to a realization? How was that for you?
The question that you're raising about how does one know when to leave is an incredibly complicated one. And I'm glad you bring up the Chagall's case, because I think that in their case, their decision was made more emotionally complicated by the fact that their daughter Ida and her husband were in France and had less of a prospect of being able to leave than the Chagalls themselves did. So I think in part, one of the difficulties was that people were connected to so many others, and the idea of leaving their families behind was in many cases intolerable. And that's one of the complications that I pursue, not only in the historical aspects of this book, but also in some of the fictional aspects, because one of the key characters has a son who is lost somewhere in Vichy France. And he returns to Europe at the peril of his own life to try to look for this son. This was a constant problem for Varian and his associates, because there were simply so many people who needed help, and some of the people who most direly needed the help refused to leave unless everyone they cared about could come along with them. And so how does one know when to leave? I mean, I think that the answer to that question is complicated so much by this nexus of an awareness of political factors and the magnetic pull of personal factors. I think it's one of the things that was most important about what Varian was doing was giving perspective. And I think that, in fact, his insistence did help in so many cases.
And talk about that process of getting people out. What was involved, and how did he do it?
Well, the most difficult part of it was the assembling of all of the necessary papers. And, you know, you look at this, and it seems like a kind of clerical problem. How do you get all of the visas to align? There has to be a French exit visa. There has to be a Spanish entry visa. There has to be a Portuguese entry visa. There has to be a U.S. entry visa. And in the United States, in order for that visa to be granted, there has to be somebody who's willing to sponsor the refugee. And all of those visas are timed. They all have to line up perfectly and be valid at the same time. And in addition to that, the refugee also has to have identity papers. So that means either a passport, or what was commonly used at the time was called an affidavit in lieu of passport, which could be issued by the United States to somebody who was stateless. And a large part of Varian's work was just helping the refugees to assemble all of these papers. And it wasn't just a matter of the papers themselves. It was, you know, getting the United States government to grant these visas, which they were not doing in great numbers at the time. Our policies were rather exclusionary and xenophobic then, not dissimilar to the way they are now. And then there was also the problem of, if somebody were to ask for a French exit visa, alerting the French authorities to their whereabouts. And so some of the papers, in fact, had to be forged in order for the refugees to be safe. So part of Varian's work was to get illegal documents for people so that they would have a greater chance of being able to leave in safety. And then, of course, once the papers were assembled, you actually had to find a way to get out of the country. So for some people, that meant going over the Pyrenees. For some people, it meant getting out by train. And for other people, especially later in Varian's time in France, it meant getting out by boat, sometimes to Africa and then trying to arrange passage to the States, and then sometimes all the way to the Caribbean, and then arranging entry to the United States from there. Any voyage that was undertaken at that time was fraught with danger because the Atlantic was laced with German U-boats, and the boats were also subject to being stopped and everyone on them being searched, and in some cases people were interned directly from the boats. So there was peril along the way, and there were many steps involved, and fueling the entire organization was money from donations, essentially. And so another part of Varian's job was to make sure that the financial resources existed to be able to actually undertake the work that would get people out.
And Julie Oringer, in the flight portfolio, you make it very clear that these resources were extremely limited, and you have a very interesting discussion in the book where somebody challenges, one of his staff challenges Varian Fry about valuing the lives of these eminent writers and artists. I mean, we're talking, you know, not only Marc Chagall, but André Breton and many others, about valuing the lives of these eminent writers and artists over the lives of ordinary people. Talk about that quandary, that sense that, you know, some people are being valued more than others. He, of course, defended it by saying this is, you know, these people are treasures that belong to all of us in terms of the European, you know, canon. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, if you'd like, I can read a little bit from that conversation.
Yes, please do.
I believe that the conversation you're referring to is between Varian and his friend Miriam Davenport, who was an art historian, studied art history at the Sorbonne, and ended up in Marseille accompanying a number of refugee artists. And then she started working for Varian's organization. And in the novel, she is one of the people who raises exactly the conundrum you're talking about. She says, let me see where I should start here. Okay. He is objecting to her leaving the organization, which she has to do to join up with her fiancé, who's in Yugoslavia at the time. And he says, who do we have who can do what you do? He meant her ability to divine from a few sketches hastily rendered down at the viewport whether a refugee had real ability, whether he was what he said he was, whether he merited the committee's attention. Listen, Varian, about that. Miriam lit another cigarette, the umpteenth in a chain. Don't you think it's rather silly? And not just silly, wrong-headed, or maybe wrong-hearted? I mean, as a basis to decide whether someone lives or dies? Because, let's be honest, that's what it'll come down to in a lot of these cases. Don't you think a middling artist deserves a chance just as much as a great one does? Varian sat back with his drink in his hand. You know how hard it is to get the New York office to come up with cash. And every day they wire me, asking me to cut back our staff, to curb expenses. It's hard to raise money, Frank Kingdon says. People still don't believe, don't fundamentally understand what they read every day in the papers. Who am I supposed to cut from the payroll? Hirschman, who knows every black marketeer in Marseille and can manipulate them all to our ends? Oppie, who knows how to turn a dollar into 10? Leon Ball, who'd be the only person we get people over the border if the border ever opens again? And now you tell me I should just say damn the expense and save any Jacques or Jill who can hold a brush. Miriam looked away as she discharged her ash into a ceramic trawler. I don't know how you're supposed to do it, she said. I don't have the answers. But I know that what we're doing is wrong. It doesn't feel humanitarian. It feels the opposite, inhumane.
So powerful. And really a conundrum. I mean, I read that and I really couldn't come up with an answer myself. On the one hand, I completely understand, and I'm so glad that Varian Fry made the choices that he did. And on the other hand, if I were one of the people who had been denied his services because I wasn't important enough, I would feel very differently.
Yeah, well, the thing that was interesting about his journey, psychologically speaking, while he was in Marseille, was that, you know, the conversation I just read represents a feeling that I believe he had early in his tenure there. And as his work evolved, and as he saw what was going on in the concentration camps of southern France, as he understood how dire the situation was and how much worse it was getting all the time, he too felt like he had to expand his operation. And he felt like he couldn't live with the terms that his organization had initially set. So he was constantly raising more money, constantly trying to get more people out. And his work turned into kind of an all-out race to save as many people as possible by the end.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Grant. He's an invented character, but central to the book. So tell us about Grant and why he's there. I mean, this is he is Varian Fry's lover in the book.
That's right.
So I guess start by telling us about Fry's sexual orientation. You know, his son has said that he definitely was bisexual, at least. He was bisexual because he was married. And so tell us about Fry, his sexual orientation, and then why you created this character, Grant.
Well, the way James Fry spoke about it both to me and in his letter to the New York Times was that, in fact, his father was gay. And despite the fact that he was married, he was a closeted homosexual. James talks about what that might have been like for his father at the time, how difficult it must have been to have had to suppress his nature during a historical moment where it would have been, you know, socially censored had he been upfront about it. I learned this about Varian Fry fairly early on in my research while reading Martin Duberman's excellent biography of Lincoln Kirstein, which details the relationship that he had with Fry at Harvard, and also in reading about Fry's relationship with Stefan Hessel, who he was romantically involved with while he was in Marseille. Hessel also writes about that relationship quite extensively in his memoir, The Power of Indignation, which was published, I believe, in 2011. Thinking about one of the issues you and I were just talking about earlier, about how personal relationships complicated the decisions of people who were in France at that time and thinking about how to get out, it seemed to me that there would have been personal factors that would have affected and mitigated Varian's decisions. And I posed the question, I think, through Grant's character, of what it would mean for somebody who was very personally important to Varian to make a demand upon him that would call upon his organization's resources and force him to have to make even more complicated decisions. Though I didn't really set out to do this, I think that also portraying Varian Fry in a relationship with another man does something that fiction is particularly suited for, which is to capture parts of the historical record that would not have been directly recorded because it would have been socially unacceptable or fear-inducing or psychologically impossible at that time. So in the absence of more evidence, despite the fact that we already have quite a lot, but in the absence of more evidence of Varian Fry's relationships with men, the novel can go into an uncharted territory and posit what things might have been like plausibly. And so I imagine a character who had been important to Varian during his Harvard days and who reappears in Marseille doing a similar kind of work, but with only one client, the son of his friend who's lost somewhere in France and who needs to be found and to get out safely. And it's in recruiting Varian's help for this friend that the two of them reconnect and the relationship between them begins to unfold. But I felt that it might be interesting to pursue a further complication in that relationship because the dynamic between these two men, between Grant and Varian, is such that Grant, who has to a greater extent than Varian lived with some degree of harmony about his homosexuality, if not total openness, is hiding something as well, which is the fact that he is of mixed race. And so in taking Varian to task for his own dishonesties, he comes to have to confront the choices that he has made and what he has chosen to hide.
Yeah, it's very powerful. In some ways, there's some parallels between the two, but race is not just a parallel, you know, in the sense of discrimination to discrimination based on sexual orientation. It's also different, and you delve into that as well.
Yes, well, I mean, I think that in a way, it's a kind of analog to the horrific social problem that was unfolding there in Europe at the time, which is that essentially people were being persecuted on the basis of their race and their religion and their cultural background. And so somebody who had come from a country and a culture in which that had been codified for centuries might have had a particular perspective on the kind of work that Varian was doing and on the necessity to see clearly what he was able to do and to try to save as many as possible.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Julie Oringer about her novel, The Flight Portfolio. Now, we don't learn until deep in the book what the flight portfolio was. It was a real thing, but not quite how it's played in the book. What was the flight portfolio in the book, and what was it in real life?
So in the book, the flight portfolio is a collection of work by the artists who are endangered. There is a character in the book, a painter, who is also a fictional character, who has the idea that a collection of the artist's work could be helpful to have as a kind of tool to bring to the States and to help in the process of fundraising. And so as he is collecting this work, his own survival, his own getting out of the country with this portfolio in hand becomes even more urgent feeling to him and to the others who are supporting him. The real life flight portfolio was a different thing. Years after the war, I think it was about 15 years after the war, Varian went back to France to try to solicit work from some of the artists who he had saved to create something that was similar, something that would be a kind of fundraising vehicle for the Emergency Rescue Committee. And he was quite successful, and there was a series of 12 lithographs that he managed to assemble. And as I discovered this in the course of my research, I thought, wouldn't it have been interesting if this had been a tool that somebody had thought to use while Varian was doing his original work in France? And it is a kind of physical manifestation of the peril of the refugees. But I think that the idea of the flight portfolio extends a bit farther than that physical object. I mean, I think that what it ends up being for Varian in the course of this novel is, you know, just his idea of all of those who he's managed to save and what they're going to be carrying forth into the world. What is important, as he knows, is not saving just the work, but saving the people who are able to produce it. And that is why his organization is committed to what it does.
This book does not go beyond these 2 years, but we do know that Varian Fry, after the war, actually died at a very early age, at 59. You write in the afterword that he suffered from bipolar disorder. He never really adjusted to post-war life. I imagine that this was really the most vivid and important thing of his life that he'd ever done. Talk about his difficulty in adjusting to the post-war period.
Well, you know, it's one of the things that was most difficult for me to learn about his story, and also one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book. I think there were a number of factors involved. I think one of the things that was most difficult was coming back to the States and trying to convince people here on the ground of just how bad things were. He wrote quite a lot and published quite a lot about that, and published his own memoir in 1945 about his experiences in Marseille. But of course, by the time his book was published, there was this general fatigue about these issues. And there was also, I think, a reluctance to see the United States in anything but a totally heroic role, which his work could not have reflected, because he met so much resistance to his operation from the U.S. State Department. So I think part of what was so hard was just communicating with people here in the States about what he had done. And then another problem was trying to figure out what he was going to do next. When he came back, the Emergency Rescue Committee wasn't even that keen on his help, because he had run afoul of so many of its members while he was in France. And so he did a number of things. He worked as kind of an advertising writer, and he taught Latin, and he did continue eventually to serve the Emergency Rescue Committee, but in different capacities here in the States. He also got divorced from his wife, who he had been married to for, I guess it would have been about 9 years before he went to Marseille. And it wasn't until after her death, about 8 years later, that he met Annette Reilly and married her. And he had three children. And he was, during the time that he was raising this family, adored his children, but also was struggling with bipolar disorder throughout that time. And I also came to understand, and have certainly come to understand further through my conversations with his son, that, you know, he was also dealing with the fact that he was gay, and that there was no way for him socially, you know, considering what the social tenor was in the United States at the time, to live in any kind of peace with that situation. And so I think part of what might have been so difficult was that while he was in Marseille, he became so very close with Stéphane Hessel and was able to have a very close relationship with him there. And then once his time in France was over, there would have been no way for that relationship to practically continue. And he would have felt deeply constrained once he came back to the States, where at the time it was illegal to be gay.
Well, it's just a terrific novel. We haven't even talked about the writing, which is absolutely stunning in its descriptive power. Julie Oringer, this has just been a fascinating conversation about a fascinating man and his project, Julian Fry. Your novel is The Flight Portfolio. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much for having me, Francesca. It's really been great to talk to you.
Find an excerpt from Julie Oringer's The Flight Portfolio at writersvoice.net. Next up, the surprising history of Audrey Hepburn in the Dutch resistance against the Nazis. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Audrey Hepburn achieved fame and fortune as a Hollywood movie star. But did you know that she took part in the Dutch resistance against the Nazis as a teenager? That's a fascinating story my guest Robert Mattson reveals in his page-turning biography of Hepburn in World War II, Dutch Girl. The third and final book in Mattson's Hollywood in World War II trilogy, previous books in the series are about Carol Lombard and Jimmy Stewart, Mattson's biography of Hepburn tells an extraordinary story of courage, tragedy, perseverance, and triumph under the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands. Robert Mattson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is just an amazing tale, the story of Audrey Hepburn and World War II, Dutch Girl. First of all, tell us about her family, where she came from, who her people were in Holland.
Well, Audrey Hepburn came from a distinguished Dutch family on her mother's side, the Van Heemstra family. It's a family that is sprinkled throughout the history of the Netherlands from, you know, its founding. And her mother was a baroness. Her grandparents were barons and baronesses. So that line goes back, you know, a long way. And on her father's side, it's quite a different story. Her father was he was Slovakian on one side and English on the other. And as a person, he was like a ne'er-do-well. He's the kind that would be played by, you know, a slimy Hollywood actor if it was a movie. So she grew up with that push and pull of an estranged father who had left the family, Audrey did, and her mother, the Baroness, who then brought Audrey into this Dutch aristocracy. And that's sort of why Audrey turned out like she did.
You open the book with something pretty shocking. You open the book with an article written by her mother in English about how great Adolf Hitler is and how wonderful Nazism is. What was that about?
Well, I wanted to introduce the reader to Ella von Heemstra, Audrey's mother, as an adorer, you know, someone who was adoring Adolf Hitler and meeting him in his office, and what a wonderful experience this was and what a wonderful man this was. This is the 1935 Hitler, and Audrey's mother was a great proponent of Nazi Germany in 1935, because Hitler was the first world leader to really bring his country back from the Great Depression, from the brink of economic annihilation, basically. And so Ella was in the aristocratic class that thought that Hitler was on the right track. And it wasn't just, it was elements in the Dutch aristocracy and also in the English aristocracy. And so Ella von Heemstra went over to Munich on a junket with British aristocrats, and they all met Hitler at once, and they toured Germany. And this became the burden that Audrey lugged around for the rest of her life, the fact that her mother had been pro-German. Audrey's mother, Ella, would be investigated after the war by the Dutch police for her beliefs and activities. And Audrey always wanted to protect her mother and did so at the expense of her own career, because she sort of, one of the reasons she shut down her career, one of the reasons she didn't take certain roles was because of her mother's activities and how they might be brought to light if she, say, did a movie about World War II. And questions started to be asked.
And in fact, she was asked by Otto Frank, Anne Frank's father, to play the role of his daughter in the Hollywood movie, and she turned it down. Is that one of the roles that she turned down because she was afraid of revealing her mother's wartime, you know, actually pre-war love of Hitler?
Yes, that's the primary one. That's the important one, because Audrey was a superstar at that time. You know, she had made some very, very popular movies, and this was around 1957-58, so it's after Sabrina, and then she made War and Peace, which was not very well received. But she was at her zenith, and Otto Frank asked her to play the part, and Audrey knew the book so well because she had actually read it in manuscript form before it was published in Amsterdam in 1946. I mean, this was the story that she related to so strongly, because Anne Frank and Audrey were like 5 weeks apart in age. They had grown up in the same country. They had experienced the same war, the same life-threatening situations. Both of them had been arrested by the Green Police, the Dutch Nazi police. And the difference was Audrey had survived. Anne Frank had not. And I think Audrey had this survivor's guilt. There were so many reasons she didn't take the part of Anne Frank. One of them being she couldn't take money for playing this, you know, this character. She thought she was too old to do it. And of course, lurking in the background was the fact that her mother had been pro-German, pro-Nazi, and there was no way that Audrey could risk having that come to light in the course of doing all of these interviews that would be necessary, not only in the States, but in Europe.
Now, situate us with, you know, the beginning of the war. In fact, Audrey Hepburn did not really grow up in Holland in her early years. She only got there when she was 11. What was going on before then?
Well, there was the rancorous separation and divorce of her parents, the ne'er-do-well Joseph Rustin and the counterculture Ella von Heemstra, and that happened in the 1930s. And when Joseph Rustin left, Audrey was soon shipped from Belgium, where they had been living, to England, to boarding school, so that she could learn English ways. And I think in the back of Ella's mind, even though it was a devastating separation when Joseph walked out, Ella hoped for reconciliation. And one of the reasons she sent Audrey to England was so she would be closer to London, where Joseph Rustin was then living. Now, Joseph Rustin became a German agent, like a full-fledged Nazi agent. And he went around through the 1930s, you know, like scoping out countryside and infrastructure and roads and communications on behalf of the Germans, because he was British and had free access. So he's out there doing all that. Ella is living the high life through the later 1930s and doesn't want to be encumbered with her daughter, sends her off to boarding school. And so Audrey is in County Kent in England for like 4 years. And then right before the war, before the occupation and after Hitler invaded Poland, Ella thought it best to bring Audrey back to the Netherlands, where Ella had set up shop in Arnhem, because Ella thought she knew Hitler very well. She had met him. This is a good man. He would never invade the Netherlands. It had been neutral in the Great War, the First World War, and it would be neutral in any Second World War. So she brought Audrey back in full confidence that she would be safe in the Netherlands. And then, of course, 5 months later, the Germans marched in.
Right. And that caused some divisions in the family, because what happened with Audrey Hepburn's older brother?
Audrey had two half-brothers from Ella's first marriage, to a von Ufort from Oosterbeek in the Netherlands. There was Alex, who came of age, was 18, 19 years old when the occupation started, and he had actually joined the Dutch army. And Audrey's second half-brother was Jan, who was too young at that time. He was like 14, 15 years old. Very withdrawn, bookish boy. Alex, when the war started, took part in some fighting when the Dutch, they actually did pretty, you know, they acquitted themselves pretty darn well, being a small country's army fighting the invading Nazis, but they got rolled over pretty quick. Alex went into hiding, became what they called an Onderdijker, because he knew once Holland capitulated that he would be conscripted into the German army, and that was not acceptable. So he went into hiding, and here was his mother, Ella, worked pretty closely with the Nazi regime as it came in, because she was still a believer, you know, through 1940, through 1941. And then, as you know, the situation changed.
Yeah, it changed drastically. I've heard it said that, you know, at first it was kind of like the frog in the water that begins to boil, you know, that things were not so bad at first. People thought, you know, they might be okay, but then things did suddenly change. How did they change?
Well, yeah, the Germans tried the velvet glove approach at first, which is what they called it. You know, the Dutch were Aryan cousins. They were to be respected. They had been global leaders. And everything was fine and going relatively well until Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, opened up the Eastern Front, and things started to go badly. And then for all of the occupied countries, things got grim in a hurry. The Germans got in a really bad mood, and they needed all of these resources to feed this endless furnace of the Eastern Front. And as that's going on, the Jews in the Netherlands start to be oppressed, and their rights were whittled away, and then they started to be sent away to the Westerbork transit camp and on to the concentration camp. So the Nazis were uncovered as the evil beasts that they were pretty quickly. So 1941, okay. 1941, the first half went okay. By the second half of 1941, things, you know, the situation revealed itself in its true horror for the Dutch people. And then became, you know, then came 1942. So the Dutch resistance started to pick up its activities in 1942, which caused great turmoil in the von Heemstra family.
Tell us about the Dutch resistance, which really began in Eastern Holland.
Well, I can speak to the situation that evolved in the Van Heemster family when there started to be acts of resistance, disruption of German communications, a planting of a bomb here, the assassination of a German officer there. The Germans decided they were going to solve this problem by taking hostage all of the leading citizens in the entire Netherlands. 1,000 people rounded up, men, 1,000 men rounded up, put in extreme South Holland in basically a very fancy concentration camp, which I visited, the remnants of it. And they were held there and they were called death candidates. And they would be shot. There would be retribution for any act of sabotage by the Dutch resistance against the Nazis. And one of the men rounded up in this first May 4th roundup of Dutch citizens was Otto Count von Limburg-Stirum, who was Ella's brother-in-law. So Ella's older sister, Meja, married this count, and who was a district attorney in Arnhem. And so now the von Heemster family is dragged into this situation, you know, where there is resistance activity that's going to result in the murder of hostages. And that was a shock because Otto was arrested by the Germans on Audrey's birthday, May 4th, 1942, which began a four-month nightmare for Audrey and the rest of the von Heemsters while he was imprisoned.
And it was very curious. He was ultimately chosen. He was chosen for death. And yet he was kind of the one of that group that didn't really belong. Why was he singled out?
See, this goes back to the von Heemsters being such a prominent family. The von Heemsters were tied up with the royal family, you know, in various ways over the decades and centuries. So Count von Limburg-Stirum, as a von Limburg-Stirum, who was one of the founding families of the Netherlands as well, and the von Heemsters, they were too public. Otto in 1941 had run afoul of the Nazi judicial system, and so he was kicked out as a district attorney in Arnhem. So he had people actively out to get him. So when there was an attack in Rotterdam on a train, there were a long list of people drawn up. 25 people finally was decided. They were going to execute 25 Rotterdam citizens in retribution for this failed attack, really. I mean, the bomb went off, but it didn't hurt anybody. And they whittled it down to 5 Rotterdam leading citizens that they were going to shoot. And then they decided, oh, no, here's Otto von Limburg-Stirum from this prominent Dutch family who was well connected to the court. Let's really hurt Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands by shooting this man. And they picked him, and also, by wild coincidence, one of Audrey's cousins, who was also a baron, was chosen to be one of the 5 that was executed. And what became, you know, it was a very famous execution on the 15th of August, 1942, in the wilds of southern Holland in a forest. These 5 men were dragged out, ordered to dig their own graves, and shot.
It is just an incredible page turner, this part of the book, where you describe, you know, everything that happened from the moment that Otto is taken out, you know, to become part of this group that's going to be executed. How did you find the record of the night that he was executed?
One of the death candidates, one of the hostages at Beekvliet, which is the seminary where they were all kept, wrote a book right after the war. And it's this little Dutch edition. It was just so helpful. So I had that as a basis. And there were a couple of other accounts from the hostages that remembered this night so vividly because these men were, you know, you heard the German boots on the floor as they came to the rooms. And these people are hoping, it's not me, it's not me. Well, it wasn't. It was Otto, dragged out from his cell. So I had those accounts. And also, when you go, it's crazy. It's crazy what happened. the day that I went to the execution site, which is on private property, I met the owner of that property, who heard firsthand from an eyewitness what had happened. And so I had down to, you know, minute by minute, basically, what happened when 50 Green police took these five men out and had them dig their own graves and shot them. How, you know, this Marinus von Herbeck, who was the groundskeeper of this property where the Germans took these men, the Germans didn't know there were any eyewitnesses, but here was this man. And his account that was passed on as an oral history to the owner of the property, you know, it was chilling and it was accurate and it meshed with history and it gave me what I needed.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Robert Mattson about his terrific history of Audrey Hepburn in World War II. It's called Dutch Girl. Otto, Audrey's uncle, was much loved by her and her family. What did his execution do to the feelings of the family toward the war?
Audrey loved this man so much. He was a father figure when she had no father. One of two in her life. The other was her grandfather, the Baron von Heemstra. She refused to ever say Otto's name to any interviewer. He was just my uncle killed in the war. You know, she kept her distance from the memory. He was a beloved man. He was an optimist. He was, you know, very religious, very committed to social justice. And here he is taken out and shot. And what it did was it brought the family together. It turned Ella away from her naive beliefs in Nazism. She had had a Nazi boyfriend. She got rid of the boyfriend. They were living in Arnhem, Audrey and Ella and Jan. The family banded together in the town of Velp, which is next to Arnhem, and they all moved into a house together that was supposed to be a house that the Baron was going to share with Mezja and Otto. And Ella's beliefs changed so profoundly that she went from a resistance designation as Gestapo. I saw the Oranjekrant newspaper in the Dutch archives that listed Ella von Heemstra, Baroness von Heemstra, Gestapo. You know, she was a suspected Nazi collaborator, known Nazi collaborator. She went from that to a member of the resistance in such short order that I was astounded that she was suddenly, within a year, trusted enough that Ella and Audrey would become involved in resistance activities. And that never would have happened if resistance leaders suspected them in any way.
So tell us about how they became involved. I mean, Audrey Hepburn was still a kid. I mean, she was like 14, 15 years old. How did she become involved?
At age 14, Audrey did become involved because, now this is where it gets complicated. So the von Heemstras moved to Velp. Living at the end of their street were the von Palants, another famous Dutch family of aristocrats living in Roosendaal Castle. So, I mean, like, that's one of the reasons that Baron von Heemstra decided to move where he moved was because he was close to the von Palants, you know, his kin from 100 years before when a von Palant married a von Heemstra. You know, this is Dutch aristocracy for you. So the visiting physician of the von Palants was Dr. Hendrik Visser te Hooft, who was this swashbuckling doctor from Velp and a resistance leader, the key resistance leader at the Velp hospital, which was resistance central. So here's this guy, this swashbuckling guy, who's going around in the LO directing the movement of Onderdijkers, you know, Jews in hiding from here to there, taking them food, forging their papers. He's directing the flow of downed Allied airmen through the area. So this is what Audrey's drawn into. She becomes his volunteer assistant, which I found out from the two daughters of Dr. Visser te Hooft. So Audrey's doing little tasks for him, and he starts to ask her to do resistance things because it was children and young people that the Germans didn't suspect. You know, the young people and the children had free rein around the town when the adults would be stopped. And so it was children who ran messages. It was children and young people who delivered the underground newspaper. And that's what Audrey got drawn into. And she would talk about it, and authors always doubted the validity. Well, how important could she have been? Well, she was very important. All of the children in Velp were very important to the resistance. And that, I'm so happy I could bring that part of it to light.
It's really a tale of incredible courage and endurance. You have descriptions of, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, the Battle of Arnhem. Velp became the most important town in the Netherlands after the Battle of Arnhem. Tell us why, and what did that mean in terms of how Audrey Hepburn experienced the last year of the war?
Well, that's a great question. After D-Day, the ruling Nazi leaders in the Netherlands, and we're talking Arthur Seyss-Inquart, Hans Albin Rauter, those two men in particular moved their offices to Velp next to Arnhem because it was this really rich town, and it still is very wealthy, that had been built on vast fortunes that had been made in the Dutch East Indies. So these stately villas and mansions in Velp drew these people to what they thought was relative safety, because it's only 40 miles from the German border. So Seyss-Inquart, who was instrumental in the murder of Otto von Limburg-Stirum, Audrey's uncle, moves like yards away from the von Heemstra home. So he's their neighbor suddenly. Hans Albin Rauter, who had ordered the execution of Otto, lives down the street, basically. You know, he's a mile away. So it drew Allied attention, Velp did, because it was right there. Then the Battle of Arnhem happened, and Velp became the front lines when Arnhem was destroyed. Refugees come streaming through, but it's also, Velp is on the main street that flows straight to Germany, so men and materiel came down Audrey's main street. She only lived, you know, 100 yards from the main street. So all of a sudden, all of the air activity, all of the bombing activity is centered on Velp of all places in the entire Netherlands. It, you know, Audrey is on the main street of the war.
So there are incredible scenes of battle, but also you talk about the unbelievable privation, the hunger that was imposed upon the Dutch in that last winter, the coldest winter in 100 years. I've heard it's described as that, when there was no fuel and there was no food. How did Audrey Hepburn experience that?
Yeah. Not only did the Germans punish the Dutch for welcoming the liberators, you know, the would-be liberators of the Bridge Too Far battle. The Germans had proven victorious. They had driven the British out of Arnhem. And not only was that going on concurrently, there was a railroad strike in the Netherlands. Between those two things, the Germans decided we're cutting off all food to the Netherlands. And they did. That set off what became known as the Hunger Winter of 1944 into 45. And throughout the Netherlands was famine and starvation, worst in the western part of the country, and Amsterdam, Rotterdam. They had it the worst, Harlem over there. But in the eastern Netherlands, where Audrey was in Velp, it was also very bad, which I learned there's been, you know, historical squabbling. Oh, it wasn't so bad in Velp because they had farmland all around and they could go get food. Well, it wasn't that simple. It was such a cold winter and there was such a lack of food that even in Velp, even where there was money, there was starvation. And Audrey contracted not only anemia, but edema. All of the children in Velp suffered edema, which is when, you know, your kidneys can no longer process because of lack of nutrition. And so your fluid starts to build up beginning at the bottom of your body and your feet and your ankles, and it moves up It got as far as Audrey's knees. She had edema and couldn't walk. I mean, there are symptoms that you get. You can't get warm. You can't walk. You don't have any energy. You know, you have aching joints. She had all of these things until there were Swedish relief efforts that finally reached Velp in March of 1945. But for about 3 months, she was in a bad way along with everyone else in Velp.
Literally starving.
Yes.
As a teenager in Arnhem, Audrey Hepburn became a prima ballerina in the town's famed ballet, as Robert Mattson recounts in his biography of Hepburn during World War II, Dutch Girl.
She lived for dance. You know, she was the Margot Fonteyn of Arnhem in her way. So when she turned 15, the Nazis ordered her to join the Kulturkammer, the Nazi Union of Artists, and she refused. She could no longer perform publicly. But she had this great experience as a dancer. You know, she got to live her dream, and she was in the lights. And so that's another part of her resistance activity, is when she could no longer perform publicly, she was living in Velp, and she started to dance for the resistance. You know, Dr. Visser ter Hoofd said, you know, your legs are the most important thing that you have to give us. Will you dance to raise money for the resistance? So she danced to raise money for Jews in hiding and for airmen who needed to be fed. She raised money that way. And so it was one of the proudest memories of her life, and one of the most positive memories was being able to fulfill her dream of being a dancer and to do it for the good guys.
And what was the impact of her experience during the war in Holland on the rest of her life? What if you had one or two things to say about that, what would you tell us?
Well, Luca Dotti, Audrey's son, was a tremendous help in the book. He told me that she always used wartime experiences to teach him life lessons. And she would put a positive spin on them. And really, the positive spin became her work for UNICEF. You know, she remembered what it was like to be a kid. She comforted kids who had lost parents in the war, who were starving in the war. She's this, you know, nurse's aide, and she's comforting children. She remembered that. And she spun that into Goodwill Ambassador for UNICEF, going into these countries to try to help children in a very similar situation, children who were scared and victimized by adults and their wars. And so really, you know, that is why I think above everything else, above her beauty and her performances on the screen, why we revere her and why she's beloved today is because of the way she took the terrible dark days of World War II and turned them into a beautiful thing.
Well, that's terrific. And it's a terrific book, Dutch Girl, Audrey Hepburn and World War II. Robert Mattson, thank you so much for bringing this important story to us.
Ah, Francesca, thank you very much.
Read an excerpt from Dutch Girl at, you guessed it, writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.